Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We must never surrender! America will get better and better! Keep hope alive! Keep hope alive! Keep hope alive!
The towering civil rights icon, Reverend Jesse Jackson, has died at the age of 84. We'll look at Jackson's historic life and legacy, from his close association with Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s to his historic presidential campaigns in the 80s to his role as a global peacemaker.
They were spending $1 trillion in Iraq on the wrong target. Overthrowing the government in Libya will begin there, billions more to restore it. $2 billion a week in Afghanistan, and yet we're laying off teachers, firemen, policemen.
We'll speak with Howard University professor Clarence Lussain and civil rights activist Larry Hamm, who served as co-chair of the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign in New Jersey in 1988 and was a Jackson delegate in 84 and 88. Plus, we hear from another Jackson delegate, Senator Bernie Sanders, about Reverend Jackson's legacy.
I happen to believe that Jesse Jackson is one of the very most significant political leaders in this country in the last 100 years.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Reverend Jesse Jackson, the civil rights leader and two-time presidential candidate, has died at his home in Chicago at the age of 84. He was a member of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s inner circle, marching alongside him for civil rights. He was with Dr. King when he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968. Reverend Jackson became the founder and president of Rainbow Push Coalition in Chicago, the first African-American to greet South African President Nelson Mandela when he came out of jail in 1990. This is Reverend Jesse Jackson on Democracy Now! Back in 2017, shortly after President Trump took office for the first time, he spoke about expanding the constitutional right to vote.
When we got the right to vote in 1965, blacks couldn't vote, white women couldn't serve on juries in the South, 18-year-olds couldn't vote, you couldn't vote bilingually, you couldn't vote bilingually. But we were able to challenge that and get proportional representation and democratize democracy.
After headlines, we'll hear from Jesse Jackson in his own words on his past appearances in Democracy Now!, and we'll speak with those who knew him well. A second round of indirect talks between the Trump administration and Iranian officials is underway in Geneva, Switzerland. Ahead of the talks, Iran's foreign ministry said it's willing to discuss limits to its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief, adding Iran will not accept zero uranium enrichment. On Monday, Iran's military staged war games in the Strait of Hormuz as the U.S. Navy steamed a second aircraft carrier strike group toward the Arabian Sea. The USS Gerald Ford is the largest Air Force carrier. It was off the coast of Venezuela when the U.S. abducted the Venezuelan president and his wife. U.S. officials said Friday Trump is considering an attack on Iran that could last for weeks. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who's been pushing for the U.S. to topple Iran's government, was in Tel Aviv Monday. A visit, he said, was to reassure the Israeli people that there's no gap between President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Iran policy.
There are two lines in the water right now. One's a diplomatic line, trying to find a way to end this regime. diplomatically that will advance our national security interest. The other line is the military option. I think President Trump is looking for which line can catch the biggest fish. The bottom line is we're into weeks, not months, in terms of decision making.
Ukrainian and Russian officials are also meeting in Geneva, Switzerland today for U.S. brokered peace talks, just days ahead of the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Russia is demanding Ukraine give up 20% of the eastern region of Donetsk, which Ukraine refuses to do. Ahead of the talks, U.S. Senators Richard Blumenthal and Sheldon Whitehouse traveled to Kyiv to meet with Ukrainian President Zelensky and vowed to pass a bill aimed at Russia. Senator Blumenthal also said the U.S. should supply Ukraine with long-range Tomahawk cruise missiles and that the Pentagon should help guarantee Ukraine's security under any deal to end Russia's war.
There have to be ironclad, airtight security guarantees as the linchpin for peace. Ukraine needs and deserves a guarantee from the United States, not just European powers, that it will be actively engaged if Russia again attacks.
In Gaza, a senior Hamas leader involved in the ceasefire negotiations tells Dropsite News Hamas will not agree to demands that it unilaterally disarm. Bassem Naim also said Hamas will not submit to Israel's demand for a total demilitarization of the Gaza Strip. This comes amidst reports that President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed back in December that Hamas would be given a two-month deadline to disarm. On Monday, the Hind Rajab Foundation said it's filed a criminal complaint in Chile seeking the prosecution of Ram Kovtun, an Israel Defense Forces sniper accused of taking part in the deadly 2024 siege of the Al-Shifa hospital. The World Health Organization reports at least 21 patients were killed during the attacks on the hospital. Meanwhile, the head of the United Nations Development Program is demanding greater access to Gaza to expand aid and recovery efforts. Administrator Alexander De Croo spoke from Gaza City.
More than 300,000 families in Gaza are looking for housing. Only 10% of people today living in Gaza have housing which has the basic accommodation. So 90% of the population is today looking for housing. You have seen in which very difficult circumstances people have to live or have to survive.
President Trump called Cuba a failed nation Monday and refused to rule out military action aimed at toppling the Cuban government. Trump spoke to reporters aboard Air Force One.
And they should absolutely make a deal because it's really a humanitarian threat. We'll see how it all turns out, but Cuba and us, we are talking. In the meantime, there's an embargo, there's no oil, there's no money, there's no anything.
Cuba's deputy foreign minister responded to Trump's remarks, writing, quote, "It's frequent for U.S. officials and diplomats to claim U.S. aggression is not responsible for difficulties in Cuba. It seems they don't listen to their president," unquote. The Trump administration's blockade of fuel has triggered a severe humanitarian and economic crisis in Cuba, compounding the impact of the U.S. economic embargo that's been in place since 1962. On Monday, Spain's foreign ministry said it would use United Nations channels to send humanitarian aid to Cuba. The announcement came a day after activists rallied outside the Cuban embassy in Mexico City, expressing solidarity with the Cuban people while protesting the U.S. blockade.
Faced with this attack that aims to leave Cuba without energy for hospitals, without fuel for its ambulances, without resources to bring food to the family table, solidarity between peoples is emerging today as the most powerful antidote against the blockade. Because while the United States government imposes sanctions and punishment, dignified governments and peoples, like Mexico's, respond with brotherhood.
Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension said Monday the FBI's formally notified investigators their agency will not receive access to evidence in the killing of Alex Preti. Freddie was shot to death in Minneapolis January 24th by Border Patrol agent Jesus Ochoa and Customs and Border Protection officer Raimundo Gutierrez, who fired 10 rounds in under 5 seconds. Six of the bullets were fired as Freddie lay motionless on the ground. The FBI previously refused to share information about the shooting of Venezuelan immigrant Julio Cesar Sosa Celis, who was shot in the leg by ICE agents who then lied about the circumstances of the shooting, and Renee Nicole Macklin Good, who was fatally shot by a Border Patrol officer on January 7th. Democratic Governor Tim Walz blasted the FBI's withholding of evidence, writing, quote, Minnesota needs impartial investigations into the shootings of American citizens on our streets. Trump's left hand cannot investigate his right hand. The families of the deceased deserve better, unquote. And on Capitol Hill, Attorney General Pam Bondi is facing bipartisan criticism after she told Congress all documents related to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have been released. That's despite the fact the Justice Department still holds almost 3 million pages. On Sunday, Republican Congressmember Tom Massey of Kentucky, who co-authored the Epstein Files Transparency Act, told ABC News more files should be released and unredacted. Massey said he no longer has confidence in Bondi as attorney general and responded to President Trump's personal attacks.
Donald Trump told us that even though, you know, he had dinner with these kinds of people in New York City and West Palm Beach, that he would be transparent, but he's not. He's still in with the Epstein class. This is the Epstein administration, and they're attacking me for trying to get these files released.
On Monday, Thomas Pritzker resigned from his position as executive chair of the Hyatt Hotels Corporation, citing his links to Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. The release of the Epstein files revealed Pritzker had been in regular contact with Epstein after his 2008 plea deal on sex crimes charges. In Los Angeles, Mayor Karen Bass Monday called for Casey Wasserman to step down as chairman of Los Angeles's 2028 Olympic Games over revelations about his ties to Epstein and Maxwell. In France, police have been searching the Arab World Institute as part of an investigation into links between its former president, Jack Lang, and Epstein. Meanwhile, Columbia University said it's cutting all ties with two faculty members in its dental college after the Epstein files revealed they had used an irregular process to help a girlfriend of Epstein gain admission. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the life and legacy of the towering civil rights icon, Reverend Jesse Jackson. He died earlier today at the age of 84. In the 1960s, Jackson worked closely with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Jackson was with King when King was assassinated in Memphis on April 4, 1968, at the Lorraine Motel. Jackson later moved to Chicago, where he founded Operation PUSH, People United to Serve Humanity. He also founded the National Rainbow Coalition. In 1984 and 1988, Jackson ran two groundbreaking presidential campaigns. In 1988, he received about 7 million votes. As a presidential candidate, he pushed for cutting the Pentagon budget while increasing domestic spending on education, housing, and health care. Jackson was also involved in international campaigns from the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa to supporting Palestinian self-determination. The Reverend Jackson was hospitalized in November for treatment of a rare and particularly severe neurodegenerative condition, progressive supranuclear palsy, PSP. In a statement, Reverend Jackson's family said, quote, Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world. His unwavering belief in justice, equality, and love uplifted millions, and we ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by, they said. This is a clip of Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking at the 1988 Democratic National Convention.
When you see Jesse Jackson, when my name goes in nomination Your name goes in nomination. I was born in Islam, but Islam was not born in me. And it wasn't born in you, and you can make it. Wherever you are tonight, you can make it. Hold your head high. Stick your chest out. You can make it. It gets dark sometimes, but the morning comes. Don't you surrender. Suffering breeds character. Character breeds faith. In the end, faith will not disappoint. You must not surrender. You may or may not get there, but just know that you are qualified. You hold on and hold out. We must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive.
That's Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking at the Democratic National Convention in 1988 when he ran for president for the second time. Jesse Jackson was born in Greenville, South Carolina, October 8, 1941. As a college student in North Carolina, Jackson became involved in the civil rights movement. By the mid-60s, he was a close aide to Martin Luther King Jr. and became national director of Operation Breadbasket, a campaign run by the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Over the past 30 years, the Reverend Jesse Jackson was a regular guest on Democracy Now! In 2011, I spoke with him shortly after the unveiling of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington, D.C.
I think we would do well to use the statue as an occasion to deal with his unfinished business. He was shot down, assassinated at age 39. His last agenda items included a poor people's campaign, the quest to end the war in Vietnam and stop the radical escalation of capital in the hands of the very wealthy. And today, here we are with too few people, with too much wealth subsidized by the government, too many unnecessary wars, and too many people in poverty. So, in some sense, this memorial gives us a rallying point to keep dealing with his unfinished business. We bail out the banks without link to lending and reinvestment, for example. The Bush tax cut extension is more money than all of the state budget deficits combined. So clearly, Wall Street has made out big time, but the poor are expanding, and we're losing jobs en masse, and we must, in fact, turn it around. He died a very unpopular man, attacked by our government, attacked by the media, shunned by many blacks themselves, for example, civil rights activists, because he dared to deal with the issue of unjust, unnecessary wars. They were spending $1 trillion in Iraq on the wrong target, overthrowing the government in Libya, well, $1 billion there, and billions more to restore it, $2 billion a week in Afghanistan, and yet we're laying off teachers, firemen, policemen. He would be distressed by that. He would be weeping about that. The bailout for these banks who drove us in the hole, and then they get bailed out without links to kind of in a reinvestment. We refortified them, not restructured them. These issues that Dr. King would have raised would be troubling, but it is his sense of outrage and conscience that make us better today. And I would hope, as Vince said, that the interpretation must lead us to his unfinished business. The dream only makes sense if it's connected to the broken promise that had been unfulfilled for 100 years. And today, the dream has to put every American back to work. That means reinvesting in the coming people bottom up. We're cutting public transportation, denying access to jobs, resegregating. Our schools are most segregated. The biggest growth in this in most states, the jail industrial complex. So he would see me raising troubling questions of conscience. So I would see this monument as an opportunity to raise issues of jobs and peace and justice.
The late Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking on Democracy Now! In 2011. He died earlier today at the age of 84. In 2008, Reverend Jackson appeared on Democracy Now! Just after Barack Obama won the Iowa caucus.
Well, that's first an historic significance. I mean, an African-American winning Iowa, for white Iowans, mature enough in their thinking to choose message and relationships over race is a big deal. Because there were those who would say, don't go to Iowa, New Hampshire, because they're not representative of the multicultural states. But so that said a lot to me about
the maturing of America. I could not help but think about the struggle to get to that point. Many journalists think it came down from the sky and it started, you know, in Boston. But this journey from the 54th Supreme Court decision to end legal apartheid in this country, having succeeded slavery, was a big moment in American history. And then in 55, the lynching of Emmett Till, which traumatized and woke up America. And then out of that, 4 months later, the sit-in of Rosa Parks and the emergence of Dr. King. And then the 1960s, students coming alive and risking and sitting in and going to jail, leading toward the 63 March where Dr. King laid out his dream of hope for the nation. And the climax in the next year in the 64 public accommodation bill. But then the same 64 says hope kept rising politically. Fannie Lou Hamer and that group at the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, challenging the liberal democratic structure of Mondale and Humphrey and Johnson in 64. And then while we supported the Democrats, they didn't have as their platform the Voting Rights Act. Johnson said to Dr. King, when asked about the Voting Rights Act, Dr. King, I like it very much, but you can't get the Voting Rights Act. The reality is, politically, that if you get the Voting Rights Act, we'll lose the South for a quarter of a century. Dr. King said, well, we have to get the Voting Rights Act. And so we marched in Selma, Alabama to get the Voting Rights Act and the blood of the people. And of course, that struggle has spawned everything politically, the 65 Voting Rights Act. And then the Hatch Edict. At that time, a black mayor of here was a national story. The black mayor of Cleveland, Carl Stokes, was a novel. It was a national story at that time. And it continued to grow. And by 72, we challenged the McGovern rules. You recall, we unseated the delegation as we sought to have a more multicultural seating of delegates from states in 72. And by 83, Harold Washington was running for mayor. And Mondale and Kennedy came in to defeat him with supporting Jane Brennan and Daley. And we resisted that, and it was this tension between our growth and the process. And out of that, it drove me, in fact, to run in 84 and 88. And we kept expanding upon that coalition. And we won with new registered voters, new voters, Democrats were getting the Senate in 86 in the South. We won North Carolina and Louisiana and Alabama and Florida. And by 88, we expanded that base. And Wallet became governor in 89, we won Virginia in 88. Wallet, Dave Dinkins became mayor of New York in 89, we won New York in 88. And so this thing has just continued. So when the media says, well, Barack was not a part of the civil rights struggle, he's a beneficiary of it. Not a benefactor of it, but each generation becomes beneficiary and then benefactor. There, this year, he's a beneficiary of that struggle. Next time, those who came in because of him, they'll be the beneficiaries, he'll be the benefactor. But the struggle continues. And so from the 54 end of apartheid to the Voting Rights Act to the urban breakthroughs to Harold Washington, the 848 campaigns, to me, this is historic, an unbroken line. And I might add, even the party resisted supporting Free Mandela. We were on the side of the South African government. We thought that was our security. So I think it's a great moment for American democracy.
That's the late Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking in 2008 on Democracy Now! It was on a Sunday after his radio show in his studio, and I had begun by asking whether he supported Senator Obama for president, even though he had not publicly endorsed his campaign. To see all our interviews with the late Reverend Jesse Jackson, you can go to democracynow.org. In 2024, on the eve of the Democratic National Convention, friends and supporters of the Reverend Jackson gathered in Chicago to pay him tribute. This is Senator Bernie Sanders.
I happen to believe that Jesse Jackson is one of the very most significant political leaders in this country in the last 100 years. And I think sometimes we take for granted all that he has accomplished and the walls that he has broken down. Today, when people say, you know, black and white and Latino and Asian American and Native American and gay and straight have got to stand together, people were not talking like that 30 or 40 years ago. And I will never forget one of the most beautiful photographs I have ever seen. Do you all recall the Reverend Jackson standing on a bale of hay in Iowa? Anybody remember that? Surrounded by white farmers. And the point that he was making there, which was a point people were not making in America at that time, is that the people who were destroying the corporate forces that were destroying family-based agriculture for white farmers in Iowa were exactly the same people who were exploiting black workers and Latino workers. And back in 84, 88, that was a pretty profound statement. So I'm not going to list for you the achievements of Jesse Jackson. You know how often he has ended up in jail fighting against racism and segregation. You know how many countless, probably hundreds and hundreds of demonstrations he has led in every part of this country. You all know his work with Dr. King, his historic and enormously important work. But Jesse's contribution to modern history is not just bringing us together, it is bringing us together around a progressive agenda. So let us be crystal clear. There would not have been, in my view, a Barack Obama in 2008 without Jesse Jackson. There would not have been a Vice President Kamala Harris in 2020 without Jesse Jackson. And there would not have been a President Kamala Harris without Jesse Jackson. You know, when I ran for president in 2016, I talked about Medicare for all and health care as a human right. Well, guess what? Jesse Jackson was there 30 years before I was. 30 years ago, he was talking about health care as a human right and universal health care. 30 years ago, he was talking about profoundly changing our national priorities, taking care of our kids, not giving tax breaks to billionaires. Jesse Jackson, 30 years ago. When he came to Burlington, Vermont, we took him to a child care center. He understood that in the richest country on earth, you don't turn your backs on the children or turn your backs on the elderly or turn your backs on the working class of this country. So I have known Jesse Jackson and his family for many, many decades. And it has been one of the honors of my life. He is a hero of mine. Proud to call him and his family friends. This, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the great heroes of American society. Thank you all very much.
Senator Bernie Sanders speaking in 2024 at an event in Chicago on the eve of the Democratic National Convention honoring the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who died today at the age of 84. In 1988, Sanders endorsed Jackson for president. At the time, he was mayor of Burlington, Vermont. Coming up, we'll speak to Howard University